Now then, look to our brother Simon Griffith to give us the first part of our study, Introduction and Background, the People, City and Temple. Ye do err, not knowing the scriptures. So said the Master to the Sadducees when they came to him with their hypothetical case of the woman that had seven husbands. And as I began to look through this, the notes and preparations for this address, it became obvious to me, brothers and sisters, and I hope it will do to you, that phrase, "ye do err, not knowing the scriptures," sums up the whole problem. And it is, of course, cause and effect. They erred, and the reason that they erred was because they didn't know the scriptures. And all that followed, all the terrible events of AD 70, all came about because they erred not knowing the scriptures. And immediately, brethren and sisters, there is a powerful exhortation. You see, the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they thought they knew their scriptures, or at least what passed as their scriptures. They knew it. They knew it inside out and back to front. They could recite it. But they erred because they didn't really know the scriptures. And the exhortation to us, brothers and sisters, is to make sure that we know what the word of our Heavenly Father actually says. And it's for us to be diligent in our studies, to come to an understanding of his inspired word. Would you come with me, please, to Deuteronomy and chapter 28. Here even Moses was able to prophesy of the terrible events. Deuteronomy and chapter 28, which I'm sure we're aware is an unfolding of the history of the people of Israel. But if we just pick up at verse 45. "Moreover, all these curses shall come upon thee, and shall pursue thee, and overtake thee, till thou be destroyed. Because thou hearkenest not to the voice of Yahweh thy God, to keep his commandments and his statutes, which he commanded thee." So here even Moses, before they'd even gone into the land, was forecasting curses that would even pursue them and overtake them. And this was because, verse 47, "thou servest not Yahweh thy God with joyfulness and with gladness of heart for the abundance of all things." And that was another difficulty they had. Abundance of all things. And it's another exhortation to each of us, brethren and sisters, because to some degree or other, and particularly if you look in other parts of the world and compare ourselves, we do have an abundance of all things. And it was part of the problem that Moses here highlighted. "And because of this, therefore thou shalt serve thine enemies, which Yahweh shall send against thee, in hunger and thirst and nakedness, and in want of all things. And he shall put a yoke of iron upon my neck." And with the use of the figure of the yoke of iron, and then a little later on the eagle is mentioned in verse 49 as the eagle flyeth. With those two symbols, we know that Moses was talking about Rome and AD 70. So here, right back in Deuteronomy, there is what we might describe as the prophetic background to the things that were going to go on. All because they erred, not knowing the scriptures. And it was a truly awful time. Just look at verse 52, for example. "He shall besiege thee at all thy gates, with thy high fenced walls come down, and wherein thou trustest, and throughout all thy land. He shall besiege in thy gates throughout thy land, which Yahweh thy God hath given thee. And thou shalt eat of the fruit of thine own body, the flesh of thy sons and of thy daughters." Such was the terrible state to which the people of Israel would be reduced, to which God's people would be reduced, because they erred, not knowing the scriptures, and as a result of that, eventually, they crucified the Son of God. Can we go to the prophet Isaiah? Because there's another phrase there which seems to sum up the state of the people of Israel. Isaiah chapter 53. Very well known words concerning our beloved master. Isaiah 53 and verse 2 says, "For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, as a root out of dry ground." And I just want to think for a moment about that expression, dry ground. It's something to which we shall refer as we progress, because it's a very neat little expression which summarises the whole problem with the people. Not only the people, but the leadership, the priests, the scribes, the Pharisees, they were dry ground. As we're all well aware, dry ground is not capable of producing fruit in whatever is planted in it. And so there is implied in this expression, dry ground, the fact that Israel were going to be completely barren at that time, as far as Yahweh was concerned. And this was the point that the Master emphasised over and over again. But verse 3 says, "He was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief." He was then rejected of men. And we tend to think of that rejection as being culminating in the crucifixion. But how else was this rejection manifested? There was a corrupt priesthood who with others took counsel how they might take him. They sent messengers with test questions to see if they could trick him in the things that they said. They watched for what they might consider to be errors so that they might take him that way. Whenever the master asked a question, they gave evasive answers. "We cannot tell," they said. They failed to appreciate the miracles. They failed to appreciate that he was the Messiah that had been spoken of in the Old Testament prophets. The leaders laid grievous burdens on the people and yet didn't lay them on themselves. They were blind leaders. They were hypocrites. And in that memorable phrase, they were whited sepulchres full of dead men's bones. This was the state of the people, the priesthood, the leaders in the Master's day. No wonder, over and again, he criticises them, and we shall see some of that as we progress. All we're really going to do is, for the most part now, look at one day in the life of the Master. We'll lead up to that, though, by looking at Mark and chapter 11. Mark chapter 11 and the first few verses tell us of the entry of the Master into Jerusalem. We're not going to concern ourselves with that, but just to set the scene, he has of course gone in on the colt and so on, and the people in verse 9 have said, "Hosanna, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord," quoting from Psalm 118. But then we read in verse 11, Jesus entered into the temple. And there are two words always translated temple. The one means literally the holy place and the most holy place, and the other means the whole of Herod's temple, including all of the courtyards, the cloisters, and the other surrounding buildings. And this is where Jesus went. He went into the whole surrounding area of the temple. And when he looked around about upon all things, now the eventide was come, he went out to Bethany with the 12. So right at the close of the day, he went into the temple, that is to say the courtyard surrounding areas, and had a look. And what did he see? Well, on the one hand, Josephus tells us that it appeared from a distance like a snow-clad mountain, for all that was not overlaid with gold was of purest white. So the overall impression was dramatic indeed. In order to get up to the temple, he had to ascend many steps from the valley below. And the reason for that is that Herod had expanded Solomon's temple, that is the courtyard for Solomon's temple. He doubled the size. Now, because it was on a hill, obviously the further away you get from the high point of the hill, so the walls that have to be produced are very high indeed. Indeed, in one place they are some 68 feet high, from the valley below up until the temple floor. Now, that's about 8 stories high. So as you drive home and you see the blocks of flats around us and so on, just count up 8 stories and imagine that as being the height of the walls around the outside of the temple courtyard. All filled in, all solid, to provide a platform for the temple. It was enormous. It was seemingly absolutely solid. But as we shall see, of course, it was not as solid as it looked. But wonderful as it was in man's eyes, we must always remember it had no spiritual significance. It was literally Herod's temple. It was built to his aggrandisement. It wasn't a temple to God at all. It was so that he might live on in the minds of the people of Israel, being this great and wonderful builder of this amazing temple. And yet, on the other hand, what else greeted the eyes of the master? The tables of the money changers. The tables of those that sold doves. Whether the sheep and the oxen that I mentioned specifically in John chapter 2 on an earlier occasion, we aren't told. But what we are told, brethren and sisters, is that there was this place of, it was a market in effect. And we'll come to see what Jesus did about that in a moment. But let's just have a look at verse 12, first of all. Mark chapter 11 and verse 12. He's got all these things now fixed in his mind, these things that he has seen. And in Mark 11 and verse 12, on the morrow, when they were come from Bethany, he was an hungered. And seeing a fig tree afar off, having leaves, he came, if haply he might find anything thereon. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for the time of figs was not yet. And then he cursed the fig tree. And some have said, well, how could Jesus curse a fig tree for not having fruit when the time of figs was not yet? But what I believe this means is that the time of the early fruit, the time when that fruit which should have been just visible, should have been there, hidden by the leaves, so that in the weeks to come, there could have been a proper harvest of figs. So I think this verse is telling us that the time of the harvest of figs was not yet, but there should have been those small figs which were obviously edible. But there were none. So therefore there would not be a harvest. There would be no fruits. But there was the show. It had the leaves. It was full of promise. Looked promising. No fruit. Typical again of the people of Israel in Yahweh's sight. Full of show. No fruit. And again, brethren and sisters, let us take the exhortation. We too can be full of show, in the sense that we come to meetings like this, we come in our respectable clothes and we pay attention to what goes on and maybe have our discussions about things of the truth. But what are we like on other days of the week, at other times of the day, when we're out and about on our daily routines or at home in our daily routines? Is the weekend just a show, but there's no fruit during the week? That's just an exhortation for each one of us to take to ourselves. Can we go to Luke and chapter 19? We will flip between the Gospels because they obviously tell us little different pieces of information. And Luke only tells us, in this next little section, Luke chapter 19 and verse 41. When he was come near, he beheld the city and wept over it, saying, if thou hadst known, even thou at least in all this day, the things which belong to thy peace, but now thou art hid from thine eyes. The Master knew, Deuteronomy 28, and of course all the other prophecies that tell us of the destruction of Jerusalem. He knew why Jerusalem was going to be destroyed. And he says that they didn't even know the things which belong to thy peace. Perhaps a play on the name of Jerusalem. They just couldn't see what would lead to peace. They thought they did. But their very lives, their very actions, their beliefs, their attitudes were far away from peace and was only going to bring destruction. Because verse 43 says, "For the day shall come upon thee that thine enemy shall cast a trench about thee, compass thee about and keep thee in on every side." It's exactly what we just read in Deuteronomy 28. "And they shall lay thee even to the ground and thy children with thee, and they shall not leave in thee one stone upon another, because thou knewest not the time of thy visitation," or investigation, or inspection. The master was there. He was inspecting them. He was telling them what was wrong. But they weren't going to put anything right, as we shall see. It's only Luke that records that very little simple prophecy of AD 70, but so powerful and so accurate. But can we go back into Mark and chapter 11? Because there we shall see what the master actually did with these people that were in the temple courtyards. Verse 15, "They came to Jerusalem, and Jesus went into the temple and began to cast out them that sold and bought in the temple." And the word "bought" means either to go or to be at market. So what he saw was a marketplace in the temple, albeit Herod's temple, but nevertheless the place where the people went to worship, and indeed where the master himself went to worship. And so he overthrew the tables of the money changers, and particularly at Passover, when they would have many people coming from abroad, they would need to be to change their currency. And the history books tell us that they did so at an exorbitant rate. And then the seat of those that sold doves, whether the oxen, sheep were there, we're not told at this time. And so he told he would not suffer any man to carry a vessel, also translated as goods, through what had become now a marketplace. Even worse, an animal marketplace. And so it is taught, he said in verse 17 unto them, "It is not written, my house shall be called of all nations a house of prayer? Ye have made it a den of thieves." Now that, of course, was a straightforward statement of fact. It was a den of thieves. They robbed the people on every occasion by their extortionate prices. It's a quotation from Zechariah 11. We'll come back to Mark, but just look at the context of the verses which the master chooses from, did I say Zechariah? It's Jeremiah. Jeremiah and chapter 7. Jeremiah 7 and verse 11. "Is this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your eyes?" Well, that's obviously the phrase that he picked up. Let's carry on, see what he says. What Jeremiah was inspired to write. "Behold, even I have seen it, saith Yahweh. Go ye now unto my place, which was in Shiloh, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it for the wickedness of my people Israel. And now, because ye have done all these works, saith Yahweh, and I spake unto you, rising up early and speaking, but ye heard not, and I called unto you, and ye answered not. Therefore will I do to this house, which is called by my name, wherein ye trust, and unto the place wherein I gave to you and to your fathers, as I have done to Shiloh. I will cast you out of my sight, as I have cast out all your brethren, the whole seed of Ephraim." So to those who knew their prophets, when Jesus said, "You've turned it into a den of robbers," he was effectively also saying that they were going to be thrown out. They were going to be cast out and destroyed, just as Shiloh had been so long ago before. One of many occasions where the master speaks to them quite directly. It goes right over their heads. They're not the slightest bit interested in being told the truth. And again, what a powerful exhortation. Mark in chapter 11 again, and verse 20. It's the next day now. And we read that in the morning they passed by and they saw the fig tree which dried up from the roots. And it dried up from the roots because the roots were in dry ground. And so it dried up from that point. And so it's called to remembrance in verse 21. And Master, behold the fig tree which thou cursed is withered away. And Jesus answering saith unto them, have faith in God, which on the face of it seems a strange thing to say. I believe what he's saying is have faith in the fact that just as Jesus has cursed this fig tree, just as God in the Old Testament prophets cursed his people Israel and forecast that they would be destroyed, he was in effect saying, have faith that these things will happen. In other words, it was a warning. And then he goes on to say in verse 23, for verily I say unto you, that whosoever shall say unto this mountain, be removed and cast into the sea, and shall not doubt in his heart, but shall believe those things which he saith shall come to pass, he shall have whatsoever he saith. This mountain. He'd come from the Mount of Olives and was facing, at least, or maybe even starting to walk, on Mount Zion. And Mount Zion, being a figure of the nation of Israel, was indeed about to be removed. It was about to be cast into the Sea of Nations. And the Master says, have faith, because this is going to happen. Israel is going to be taken off the land because of their faithlessness. I move now into Matthew, where Jesus is still in the temple, or has reached the temple, we should say. And in Matthew and chapter 21 and verse 23... We should have mentioned incidentally that with the curse of the fig tree, this is the beginning of the day which will occupy the rest of our time. It's amazing how much was crammed into this day. And so in verse 23, Jesus is asked the question in of Matthew 21. In verse 23, that's the wrong verse, but we'll come to verse 23. No, I'm in chapter 22, sorry. You're there, I'm not. Verse 23, there we are. Then he was come to the temple, and the chief priests and the elders of the people came unto him as he was teaching and said, by what authority doest thou these things, and who gavest thee this authority? Now, it was while he was teaching, we are specifically told, that doubtless in the back of their mind was the events of the day before. He'd thrown out the marketplace, and it was the priests that had the control over the economy of the temple. They controlled every single step of the way, from the dovecotes on Mount Olives, right through to the money changers and the selling of the animals. The whole thing was in the control of the chief priests. And they were as rotten, as corrupt as could be. And they had the nerve to say, by what authority doest thou these things? In other words, they utterly failed to appreciate he was the Son of God. He was the Messiah. And yet these were the chief priests and the elders of the people. Further example of the dry ground. And so we know that Jesus poses the question about the baptism of John. And it's interesting to see how they formulate their answer. Middle of verse 25, they reasoned with themselves, saying, if we say from heaven, he will say to us this and so. If we say of men, then they had another problem. And so Jesus asked them a simple question. Actually giving a truthful answer didn't seem to cross their minds. All they were concerned about was, if we give this answer, there's this consequence. If we give another answer, there's a separate consequence. We think spin doctors are something new. It's right here. They were concerned with the consequences. How would play in public? The truth of the matter never even crossed their minds. Dry ground. erring, not knowing the scriptures. And this was the state of the priesthood. And then there is the man with two sons in verse 28 that Jesus speaks of. The one who said, "I go, sir," and didn't go. And the other who said, "I will not," but then repented. And here the master was pointing straight at the priests. Those who professed to be doing the will of their father, but were doing no such thing. And yet, the poorer people, the publicans and the harlots, those that were paying attention to what the master said, would go in front of into the kingdom in front of them. And notice how you could almost imagine Jesus standing there with the scribes and the Pharisees and the priests on this occasion. Almost, perhaps he was even jabbing his finger. Just look at verse 31, the middle of verse 31. "Verily I say unto you, the publicans and the harlots go into the kingdom of God before you." This was the priests he was talking to. "John came to you in the way of the wilderness, and ye believed him not." The publicans and harlots believed, and ye, when ye had seen it, repented not afterward, that ye might believe. Staring straight in the face and telling them exactly what was wrong. And it went straight past by them. They hadn't got a clue. Or at least, they did know what he was talking about, but they didn't want to know. That's something that comes out in a moment. Verse 33 tells us here was another parable. The man with the vineyard. Of course, we know he sends his servants and his son. And in verse 37, "Last of all, he sent unto them his son, saying, They will reverence my son." Mark says, "My one son." Luke says, "My beloved son." How specific could this be that Jesus was talking about himself? By what authority doest thou these things? He's telling them the answer. And what do they do? "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him." And so on. In verse 40, "When the Lord therefore of the vineyard shall come, what will he do to these husbandmen?" Now the husbandmen are of course the scribes of the priests that he's talking to. And they say, "He will miserably destroy those wicked men and will let out his vineyard to other husbandmen, which will render him the fruit in their seasons." So Jesus, with his questions and answers, had caused the very priests themselves to prophesy about AD 70. But they still couldn't see it. Didn't want to see it. And the word "wicked" there means worthless or depraved. And that was how they were forced, in effect, to describe themselves. And so Jesus then quotes Psalm 118. Just as an aside, perhaps one of several occasions where something which has been said earlier, in this case, "Hosanna to the Son of David," is a quotation from Psalm 118 by other people, which at some point later on, the Master seems to pick up. Be that as it may, he quotes the Psalm, but the point, of course, of the quotation is in verse 44, when he expands on it and says, "Whosoever shall fall on this stone shall be broken to pieces," which of course they were falling, they were stumbling. "On the other hand, on whomsoever it shall fall, it shall grind him to powder." Another prophecy of AD 70 because of the state of the priests and the Pharisees. And just look at verse 45, how damning it is. I've said on several occasions, it passed them by. But it was because they were willingly blind to it. "When the chief priests and the Pharisees heard his parables, they perceived," and the word is to know absolutely, "they perceived that he spake of them, but it didn't affect them. It was water off a duck's back. Just look at what they did. When they sought to lay hold hands on him, because they feared the multitude, because they took him for a prophet." So their reaction to having this prophecy straight directly at them, and they knew it was about them. They'd even said themselves that he would destroy them. So their reaction was quite simply get in first and destroy him. they erred, not knowing the scriptures. This was a terrible state of the people of Israel at that time. The next chapter details the wedding invitation and those who made light of it. Verse 5 of chapter 22. They made light of it and went their ways, one to his farm, one to his merchandise. Notice how that just links in with the animals and the money changes and so on in the temple. There were those that reared the animals, they brought them to the temple, they then had the money changes and so on, and it's right here. Their merchandise, their farms. And so we read on, and what do we read in verse 8? In the middle of the verse, he sent forth his armies and destroyed those murderers and burnt up their city. And in a few words, what a very accurate description. Verse 8. In the middle of the verse, he sent forth his armies and destroyed those murderers and burnt up their city. And in a few words, what a very accurate description again of AD 70. He sent forth his armies, he destroyed the murderers, and of course they were going to be murderers because they were going to murder Christ, and burnt their city, which was exactly what the Romans did. Just a few words, astonishing accuracy of prophecy. And to destroy fully literally means to ruin, or indeed to be off. In other words, off the land, destroyed off the land. And that was exactly what was going to happen. But then in verse 15, the Pharisees come and they take counsel how they might engage him in their talk. And they sent him out with the disciples of the Herodians. Now this tells us how desperate they were. The Pharisees and the Herodians. Let's think for a moment about the groups of people that were there. The scribes, first of all, those that copied the scriptures originally with diligence and with reverence. But over time, they included oral traditions and the rabbinic teachings and other human traditions. And that became known as the Talmud. And eventually they began to revere the human writings above Yahweh's law itself. Over time they moved into the public eye, the public arena, and began to teach. And they became leaders in the synagogue. But they were teaching the things of men above the things of God. Now most scribes, we're told, were also Pharisees. And the Pharisees were the largest religious group at the time of Christ. And they put into practice, and indeed tried to impose on others, the ridiculous rules that the scribes had woven around and over and above the law of God. That they were not even supposed to eat an egg that had been laid on the Sabbath. So ridiculous had these things become. This led to hypocrisy, it led to self-righteousness, it led to a public showing off, and all of these things were roundly condemned. But what the Pharisees were very Jewish. They were very nationalistic. They wanted the land for the Jews. And of course it was an occupied land, occupied by the Romans. The Herodians, as we might imagine by their very name, had a great deal of sympathy, not only with Herod, but with the Roman occupiers. And so the Pharisees and the Herodians were really very strange bedfellows indeed. They were at opposite poles, almost opposite poles, of the political spectrum. But they were willing to come together because they had a common enemy, and that was Christ. How desperate, how awful was the state of the people of Israel. No wonder the Romans were going to come and cleanse the land. And then Jesus comes to the Sadducees. We haven't got time to deal with the inscription, but it was a very political question about whether they should really submit to the rule of Rome or not. Then come the Sadducees with their hypothetical question. And the Sadducees were a small group, but they held the first five books of the Bible as being of absolute importance. and wouldn't take a great deal of interest, not only in the rest of the scriptures, but certainly not in the man-made traditions. So you've got this wide variety of political and religious understanding. So this led the Sadducees to reject the doctrine of the resurrection, because as far as they could see, it wasn't mentioned in the first five books of the Bible. Now, if they had a concordance in their day, and like we do, and they look up the word resurrection, they'd be absolutely right. But they erred, not knowing the scriptures. They couldn't bring together the scriptures and their understanding. They couldn't look at the Bible and try to think, well, what does this mean? And so where does the master quote? He quotes from Exodus, straight from the books that they revered and understood, and demonstrates their lack of understanding. These were mostly rich, the Sadducees. They were rich people, they were outward looking, they were quite happy to go along with the people of Rome. And so Jesus condemns them. They were political rather than religious, and yet it was through the religion that they made their money, because it was from the Sadducees that the high priests came. Remember, the high priest in those days was a Roman appointment. It was a Roman appointment to the highest bidder. So they got their wealth, or they had their wealth, they became the priest, they controlled the temple economy, and it was a license to print money. And so he condemns them utterly, not knowing the scriptures. And in the following chapter, in chapter 23, Jesus condemns them over and over again. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. And this was a terrible accusation. They were pretending to be one thing, but inwardly they were something else. Full of dead men's bones, as we read in verse 27. But perhaps their worst hypocrisy was in verse 29. Verse 30, sorry. And you say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. And they'd been conspiring for probably something like 3 years to murder none other than their Messiah. We wouldn't be partakers of the blood, they said. And they'd been planning it for 3 years. This was the desperate state of the people of Israel. Worse than that, it was the desperate state of the chosen people of God. They who should have been so separate from the nations round about, those who should have revered the word and nothing else other than the word, those who should have been so willing to take to themselves the teaching of the Master, to appreciate his miracles and the other things which he did and said. And for most part, the leaders in particular could only reject it. And so in verse 37, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which be sent thee, how often would I have gathered thee together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings? But ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. But they were there in the temple. These huge, vast stones that had been caused to be quarried and built. This huge platform that had been built so that the temple might stand upon it. It couldn't be moved, could it? It couldn't be destroyed. But it was going to be desolate. It was going to be desolate because they themselves were desolate of spiritual things. And so Jesus says in verse 1 of chapter 24, Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and disciples came to show him the buildings of the temple. And he said unto them, see all these things, I say unto you, they shall not be left here, but one stone upon another shall not be cast down. It was going to be destroyed. And so as a result, of course, there were those questions that were asked. A series of questions to which the Master gave a series of answers. And it falls to the lot of our brethren that follow to look at those questions and answers in some detail and expound to us the prophecy which our Master gave, and how we look forward to those times yet to come.